Welcome everybody. This is the third lecture in our course on Asian Buddhist women. And today it is my great pleasure to welcome Vanessa Sassoon, who is going to speak to us on the topic of children in the Pali Canon. Vanessa Sassoon is a professor of religious studies in the liberal arts department of Marianopolis College, where she has been teaching since 1999. She is also a research fellow for the Institute for Studies in Race, Reconciliation and Social Justice at the University of the Free State, as well as adjunct professor of comparative religion at McGill University. She has published a number of articles and book chapters. She is the author of The Birth of Moses and the Buddha, a paradigm for the comparative study of religions, published by Sheffield University Press in 2007, and co-editor with Jane Mary Law of Imagining the Fetus, the Inborn and the Unborn in Myth, Religion and Culture, Oxford University Press 2009. And she is editor of Little Buddhas, Children and Childhoods in Buddhist Texts and Traditions, Oxford University Press 2013. So with this, I leave you and welcome to Vanessa Sassoon.
Good morning. I don't know if it's morning where everyone is. I hope you can hear me. Thank you to Bhikkhu Analayo. It's a pleasure to be participating in this program. It's a wonderful course. Wonderful project, so I'm really happy to be part of it, and I hope I can be helpful over the next hour and a half. So I have to admit that I've never done a full online class before, so I find it a bit odd. I think if you ask questions and comment as we go, I'll feel like I'm actually talking to someone, which will be nice, because I can't see any of your faces, which I would have liked. Okay, so what I want to talk about, I have been thinking about this lecture for a few months and thinking about how I wanted to organize it. I was originally going to do things that I knew a bit better, and then I thought I would try out some new material that I'm thinking about for a new book. And so it's a focus on children in the Pali Canon, and it's a little bit more specific than even what I've called children in the Pali Canon. It's also going to be a focus, this lecture at least, is going to be focused on the precocious child and what that means in the Pali Canon. I realize that this lecture is a little bit different from a lot of the lectures that you'll be receiving. The course is a course about women and South Asian women in Buddhism. This is about children, and what is, I'm sure you guys are going to pick up on very quickly, is that there are actually very few female children. Actually, I have no examples of female precocious children in the literature that I've been scanning. So if any of you, oh, my voice is weak. Okay, can you hear me better now? Is this better? My microphone doesn't seem to... okay. I'm going to come really close to my computer screen. So I'll be looking forward to your comments, and if you have thoughts on the material or commentary, it would be great to hear what you have to say, because this is kind of new and exciting for me, so I'm looking forward to a good conversation. So what I want to start with is a question about research in the Western Academy about children in Buddhism. I'm sure that anyone who lives in a Buddhist community is fully aware of how important children are to Buddhist communities so that they can thrive. Children are everywhere in Buddhist communities. We need to have schools for children. They run around in monasteries. They're part of every human community. They can't not be. There are vinaya rules for children. Children are part of the background of any live human community. But for a number of reasons that I'll help identify, there's been actually very little research done on children in Buddhism in Western scholarship. So I'm going to try to... here we go. When I did the book on little Buddhas, it was literally after having my own child and thinking to myself, where is the resources? Where's the research? How come there's no discussion about children in Buddhism? And I had to really scan to look for stuff. I found some random articles here and there. There's Alan Cole, who's done a significant amount of work. But for the most part, there's been very little discussion about children in Buddhism. And I have a couple of theories as to why that might be the case. Number one is Western scholarship was, for the most part, has been very interested in the celibacy and the monastic life of Buddhism, which is a really dominant part of Buddhist life, obviously. But that created a kind of emphasis on adulthood as well, which is not always the case. Not all monastics are adults. Rita Gross, who some of you I'm sure are familiar with her work, she wrote a number of articles on children and Buddhism over the years. She's one of the few who did that. But her views were, to some extent, limiting. She, and here's a very important quote from one of her books. She actually uses this quote a few times. She kind of rehashed her work a few times. And so, since developing enlightened attitudes is so basic to Buddhism, its central space is the meditation hall, not the fields, the hearth, the sacramental table, the sacrificial altar, or the bazaar. People fare best in the meditation hall as adult individuals, which is why Buddhism is not especially oriented towards or focused on families and children, however important these concerns are to some Buddhists. This view, I think, has dominated Western scholarship for a long time, and it was why I created that book on children and Buddhism a few years ago to try and address the question, is there more to be said about children than just that they're not relevant or that they're not central to the tradition? I think Rita Gross is right to some extent. Obviously, the meditation hall is a very important space in Buddhism, but I don't think this is the only way that we can broach the subject. And I tackle this question a bit in the introduction to my book, which I shared with you. I think it was made available through PDF. But I don't think this is the only reason why. There's another reason that I actually didn't put in the PowerPoint that I thought a lot about, but it's hard to articulate at times. As Bhikkhu Anilayo mentioned, I'm also a professor of comparative religion. My training was as a comparativist, and I compared biblical and rabbinic texts with early Pali and Sanskrit texts. And being exposed to the biblical and rabbinic field of academic research really affects how I understand Buddhist studies. The amount of research that is available in Western scholarship on the Bible is overwhelming. If you go to a conference or you go to a book exhibition hall, the amount of materials, if you go to the AAR and you see the SBL exhibits, of all the material that is being published on the Bible, it is completely overwhelming and saturated. You have to get a niche, a tiny, tiny niche, and specialize on one verse or one part of a verse to be able to publish anything anymore. It's a really saturated field. By comparison, Buddhist studies really is just getting off the ground. I think this has an impact. I think we're just getting to know Buddhism in Western scholarship, and we're undoing assumptions and expectations as we go. And I think one of those assumptions was that Buddhism had little to say about children because we weren't looking for it. And I don't think that that's a detrimental reality. I think it's just part of our growing up with the tradition and getting to know it for the first time in the West. So I think this is also a big part of the reality. And I think it's worth noting, and I think it becomes really obvious when you compare scholarship in two different fields. So I think those are possible reasons why. The other reasons, number two and three, that I put on the PowerPoint are also really, really striking, is that if the only engagement that we have with Buddhism is through texts, which for the most part I think was true for a long time, the most dominant narratives, and narratives are very powerful ways to engage with the tradition, are the stories of the Buddha himself in his last life and the story of the Visuddhijataka. In both these stories, we have very powerful and potentially very detrimental images of what it is to care for a child. In the story of the Buddha in his last life, we have a man who is on a quest, and to achieve what he wants to achieve and fulfill that quest, he has to leave his family behind. And it's a devastating story. One of the things that I've always appreciated about this story is that the tradition leaves it this way, that the tradition leaves the Buddha with his son and his wife, and they leave a complicated and upsetting narrative in which a man walks away from his family. In the Jataka Nidana, some of you may be familiar with this, there's a very touching little detail left in the narrative where, after he has decided that he would leave home, and he has seen the four sights, he goes back and he sees his wife, Yashoda, well, she's not named, but he sees his wife and his newborn son, and he wants to touch the child, but he knows that if he touches the child, he's going to wake her up, and if he wakes her up, he won't be able to leave. The text doesn't tell us why he won't be able to leave, so we don't know if it's she will do something or if it will be too hard for him, but he can't leave if he touches and he wakes her up. And so there's a sense of pathos and sadness and complexity to this narrative. But at the end of the day, he leaves. And it's a sad story. When I talked about it recently with my students, and I told it from this perspective of sadness, and they all kind of left the class feeling quite devastated about this narrative, of this pull that this tradition is invoking of what it seems to be one or the other. But to achieve this ultimate goal, he has to leave home. That has led some people to view the tradition as him not fulfilling his dharma, which would be a traditional Indian way of reading the narrative, is that he had a responsibility, his dharma, to his family, to his son, to the king, to his subjects, and he broke his dharma to pursue his quest. An alternative interpretation, obviously, is that he was fulfilling a higher dharma, but for those who were left behind, he leaves people behind, and he breaks his responsibilities to them. So there's a lot of complexity to this narrative, and it can certainly lead us to imagine that the conclusion must be to achieve any kind of great spiritual height, we have to walk away from our children and our families. This is an obvious kind of conclusion to these narratives. I don't think it's the only one. I'm not suggesting that. But I think this is why we had so little discussion about children in Buddhism. The other story that I think has had a great impact on how we understand Buddhism is the very famous Visantra Jataka. I'm assuming most of you, I don't know anything about you, but I'm familiar to a lot of you. The Visantra Jataka is probably the most famous Jataka and the most famous narrative outside of the Buddha's own personal narrative. And again, a kind of very heart-wrenching, I mean, more heart-wrenching than the Buddha's last life. The Buddha's last life narrative is touching and sad and much softer in a lot of ways. But the Visantra Jataka is devastating. And so when I've read it with my students, their responses to it have been really very strong. When the first time they read it, they're shocked and upset about the narrative. And there's a lot to be upset about when you first engage it. And so what you have here is a narrative where to perfect a virtue, it seems as though he's breaking all other virtues. And that's the complexity of this narrative. And the tradition doesn't clean it up or try to make everything okay. It leaves us with this problem as the Bodhisattva is on this quest to become perfect in his generosity. He hurts everything in his path. And so he hurts his kingdom and he hurts his subjects and presumably his father again and his mother. And then when they go to the forest, and this is the very famous moment in the Visantra Jataka, the terrible Jujaka arrives and he wants slaves and he goes to see Visantra and he says, I need some slaves because my wife refuses to work, which is just a terrible situation. And the Bodhisattva has this really complicated set of reactions, and on the one hand he has excitement because he thinks, wow, I'm going to be able to perfect my generosity now. The moment has arisen and so I can give my children and really be generous. And on the other hand, he's devastated by it. And so again, it's this pull, this tug of war that's happening in him and potentially in the tradition of what do we do in these situations? And so he gives the children to Jujaka. And the children are devastated. If you've read the story, not just heard the bare outlines, it's a very emotional story. And there's a lot of emotional detail in the Pali version of it, where the children run away and they run and they go and they hide in a lotus pond. And they put the lotus flowers over their heads to hide. And then one of the sweetest details to me is when the father, so Visantra goes to find them, and they've run away because they don't want to go with Jujaka. And so the father goes to find them, and when he calls them, the text says that the children can't reject their father's voice. And so because he calls, they have to answer, which gives us a sense of the tenderness of the relationship between the father and these children, that these children are well behaved and they love their father and they don't want to reject their father by ignoring him, even though the situation is so awful. And so despite their fear, they must listen to their father, and they get out and he gives them again and they run away again and they clutch at his legs and they're crying and he pulls them off and he tells them, I have to do this. It's a really very difficult narrative. And he hands them over to Jujaka. And then the authors of this narrative go even further, because then Jujaka takes out a stick and he starts to beat them as he pulls them away and they're crying. And so it's a really tormented narrative. And then it doesn't end there, because then Vasantra is left all by himself in the woods. Madi, his wife, is out picking fruits, and so she doesn't know what's happening. And he has this thought, a really striking detail in the text, where he has this thought, maybe I should go and kill Jutaka and get my children back. And then he stops and says, no, I've given what I need to. Like, once it's given, you have to give. So it's not a story that celebrates the giving. It's a story that really is very tormented by this as an attempt to try to perfect this virtue. Now, I see there's a question. The Buddha's teachings about dispassion to interpret the action as an emotional feeling goes against the knowledge of his predicament. Are we not implying or judging his actions? Well, first of all, he's not a Buddha yet. He's still a bodhisattva, which is a really important detail. I can see why you're asking this question. But certainly from the way of the way I'm reading it as a narrative, as a story. And as a story of a character before he achieves awakening, and as literature that has all of, like, there's a whole series of these Jataka stories where the characters are, they seem more complex and not completely dispassionate yet. That, and this is the whole point of being a bodhisattva. If he was a Buddha, it would be a different question. So the same with when he leaves his son behind, he still hasn't achieved awakening. And so I think you can see, potentially, you can read into this story a possibility of some emotional struggle. Once he becomes awakened, I think then reading his narratives is very different. But he's not awakened yet, so I think he's still struggling on the road to achieving awakening. Now again, I'm just providing one kind of literary way of approaching these texts. There are so many ways to read these stories because they're so rich and full of potential. I hope that kind of addresses your question. So I think these kinds of stories, when we need them face on, really can be interpreted as though Buddhism is saying, put your children away, or ignore them, or worse, give them to a slave, a terrible man like Jujika. I think this is one of the reasons why we haven't taken that much interest in children. But as I'm going to show, I think there's a lot to be said about children in the tradition. So I'm just seeing another question. Talking of a comparative approach, our class at the Dharma Drum Institute, I love the Dharma Drum Institute, it's a beautiful space. Notice the parallel between Vasantra and the Binding of Isaac. Yes, it's a really good parallel. Seemingly, Isaac was already a grown-up son by then. We are no experts in biblical studies, but read that the book of Genesis does not tell the age of Isaac at the time. That's right. The Talmudic experts indicate that Isaac was 37, likely based on the next biblical story, which is Sarasvati. That's right. The 90 when Isaac was born. He was nonetheless a child. This reminds us of your comments on the many senses world child. Yeah, no, it's a really good point. I'm very interested in this parallel. It's one of the articles I'm hoping to write eventually, is comparing these two stories of Isaac and Vasantra. And you're right that in the case of Isaac, even though he's described as a son, the word is for son, I think, but I have to look at the Bible again. He is traditionally understood to be 37 years old. And that has all kinds of implications because then it means that he has to participate in his own sacrifice. Because if he were a child, then he could be just sacrificed. But as a 37-year-old man, you can't just... He has some agency at this point. So there's a lot to be said about that. And just as I think the children in the Vasantra Jataka have a lot of agency, they choose to run away, they choose to come back, they choose to beg their fathers. They are active agents. They're not just infants that have nothing, that can't do anything. So the children actually in the Vasantra Jataka, I think, are more complex than what we've often allowed ourselves to see. But that's a wonderful parallel. Thank you for that, Bhikkhuni. So this is kind of to give you a background of why I think we have not given that much attention to children in Buddhism, but I think there's a lot to be said, and I think there's like a whole venue of opportunity here to think about this again almost as though for the first time. So I've been thinking about the role of children in Buddhism for many years, but the way in which I'm going to be talking about it is quite new for me. Somebody else. Are these stories meant to be taken literally, or are they meant to point to the idea of giving something up of great value in the world as part of the developing a spiritual path? That's a fascinating question, I love questions like that. If you were standing in front of me, my response would be, what do you think? I think that's really more the way to handle a question like that, is you have to decide what you think these stories are meant to do. We can't ever tell what the intentions of texts are because we don't know who the authors were and we don't have access to them. So at some point you have to decide what you think the intention is. Well, if you think they're metaphors, then you read them from that perspective, right? And then you see things in it that somebody who will take it more literally will see something else in it. And that's what makes the conversation of an intellectual tradition so interesting, is we all bring to our text what we see through our own eyes, and the conversation can happen. If there's only one way to read a text, there's very little conversation to be had. So there has to be, you know, kind of a multiplicity of voices. That's what makes a classroom so much fun. Okay, so I want to look at a particular theme that I talked about before. This is a little bit influenced by one of the articles in my book on Little Buddhas, an article produced by Miriam Levering, where she looked at, it was an edited volume, and she was looking at the precocious child in Chinese Buddhism, and that got me thinking to the precocious child in the Pali Canon. Now, precocious, someone who's advanced beyond their age, the biological age, right? And so someone who seems to display all kinds of qualities that their age seems to be advanced. And so the first character, obviously, that's going to display all kinds of precocious capacities is going to be the Bodhisattva, but it's not just the Bodhisattva. So I'm going to give this as foreground, but there's a really easy kind of counter-argument to everything I'm going to say, which is going to explain my second bit. So I want to talk about the Bodhisattva in his past lives and the kinds of qualities that he shows. Now, I've chosen three jatakas here. I wasn't quite sure about the timing and how this would work for an hour and a half, so I'm going to talk, and hopefully I'll make it through to the end. I hope I haven't too little. We'll see how the timing works. So the first one, to go back to the Sanjaya Jataka, because it's so famous and so powerful, and so we have this relationship to it. This is a very famous image from Sanchi Stupa, for those of you who wonder what the image is from. And it tells there's a technical term for it, but I don't remember what it is, when images are shown in order. And so it's almost like a comic book strip. Shows you different scenes of his life story. And so you see Visantra and his wife, Madi, in their hut there. So in the Visantra Jataka, we have this complex narrative about Visantra giving away his child. I did briefly touch on the fact that I think his children are more interesting than we often assume, because I think they have a lot more personality. The tradition could have made it more easy on themselves by just kind of eliminating any character and just having infants handed over and having them not say anything, but they don't. And so the authors of this tradition, whoever they were, give us children who are complicated and emotional and very present, which is what makes the story so upsetting, or certainly enhances it. But there's another child in this story, and at least I did for a very long time. I didn't really notice him until I went back to the text. And that's the child, Bodhisattva, when he's born. Passages up, or kind of references up on the PowerPoint. So when he's born, so there's one verse, just when he comes into the womb, and this is something we see over and over again in Buddhist literature, is these kind of perfect birth narratives, which, as an aside, I didn't experience when I gave birth to my son. Right? So there's this very idealized experience of what is normally something of tremendous pain and suffering, but isn't in the case of a great being. And so the text says, this is the Pali version of the Visantra Jataka, the great being came from his mother's womb, free from impurity. So I have it here on the PowerPoint, open-eyed, and on the instant holding out his hand to his mother, he said, "Mother, I wish to make some gift. Is there anything?" And she replied, now this is, to me, just this moment, she replied is very interesting. "If my son, as he came out of the womb, spoke to me, I would be worried." But here you have the newborn child who is speaking to his mother, and she just replies to him as though this is an ordinary transaction. And she replies, "Yes, my son, give as you will." And she drops a purse of 1,000 pieces into his outstretched hand. So right away, he comes out of the birth, out of the womb, and he's ready to perfect generosity. This is what this lifetime is going to be dedicated to. He needs to do it. And so he comes out of the womb, and he's speaking, and he's thinking, and he's ready to engage in the world. This is the very definition of precocious. This is also, we could read this as a miracle story. We could read this as a kind of hopeful narrative of what some infants may be capable of. There's all kinds of ways of reading this. But I think what it tells us is that there's an imagination of children from very beginning having qualities and having desires and having something within them ready to share with the world. A couple of verses later, we have the king now has 60,000 children that are born around the same time as his son, and so he cares for all of them. He has 60 nurses taking care of his son, and he has 60,000 nurses taking care of the 60,000 other children. So we have this very elaborate kind of setup stage. And the king then caused to be made a prince's necklace with 100,000 pieces of money, and he gave it to his son. But he, being 4 or 5 years of age, gave it away to his nurses, nor would he take it back when the nurses wished to give it to him. And they told this to the king, who said, "What my son has given is well given, be it a Brahmin's gift." And he had another necklace made. But the prince, again, still in his childhood, gave this too to his nurses, and 9 times over. Right? And so now the child is 5 or 6 years old, and he cannot withhold the giving, and he has to give. Now, I'm sure we've met children who have very generous impulses and just need to give because that is their character, but usually it's a very short time span. This is something that the tradition is telling us is following the child from the moment he's born. I keep thinking when I read this literature of the arguments that are happening in certain fields right now, particularly amongst neuroscientists and linguists, of whether or not we're a blank slate. And the dominant argument that's coming out of many scholars that I've been reading is that we are not a blank slate, and that we have a neurological makeup that sets up us to have certain characteristics already. This is very much in line with what the Buddhist tradition is arguing, is that you come into the world already with your karma and your mind intact in a particular way, with certain capacities and propensities. So here, this child has come into the world ready to be generous and wanting to be generous, and he gives and he gives, and his father cannot stop him. Now, the most powerful part of this narrative to me comes a little bit later when he's 8 years old. And this is when he makes his great declaration. And it says, "When he was 8 years old, as he reclined on his couch, the boy thought to himself, 'All that I give comes from without, and this does not satisfy me. I wish to give something of my very own. If one should ask of my heart, I would cut open my breast, and I would tear it out and give it. If one asked of my eyes, I would pluck out my eyes and give them. If one should ask my flesh, I would cut off all the flesh of my body and give it.' And thus he pondered with all his being in the depths of his heart, this earth, 40,000 quadrillions of leagues in extent, 200,000 of leagues in depth, quaked and thundering like a great mad elephant. Cimmeru, chief of the mountains, bowed like a sapling in the hot steam and seemed to dance, and stood leaning towards the city of Jetutara. At the earth's rumbling, the sky thundered with lightning and rain. Forked lightning flashed, the ocean was stirred up." And so this is, I mean, an extraordinary moment. He's 8 years old. He's not the Buddha yet. He will not be the Buddha in this lifetime. And yet at 8 years old, he's having a thought of such profound generosity, such a profound awareness of what it is that he wants to accomplish, that the universe is completely toppling over itself with a response. It's a cosmic response to a moment that has cosmic impact. And what has cosmic impact is an eight-year-old boy's desire. I don't know, and again, I say this from the perspective of comparative biblical rabbinic materials, I don't know of anything quite like this in the biblical tradition of so much impact coming from one child. The only kind of counter example that I can think of is with Jesus as God himself coming to earth. But this is happening with the Buddha before he's the Buddha. And this is going to happen with other children as well. And so I find that this gives a really powerful presence and space to children in the tradition that I haven't really seen anywhere else. And that's what's fascinating to me. So that's the Santra Jataka. I'm going to look at a few more. Just two more from the Mahanipata, the last 10. So the collection of the last 10 Jataka stories is known as the Mahanipata. This is a collection, a term that was applied to it later. How late, we're not quite sure. Naomi Appleton's work on this is really very helpful. But these last 10 Jataka stories have a very special place in the tradition, and they eventually came to be understood as the 10 lifetimes in which he perfects a different virtue each time. Which virtue is being practiced is not always clear. It depends which text you're going to use for that, but they're very powerful texts, and they tend to, in many temples around the Buddhist world, we'll see images of these 10 together. And so I thought it would be useful to look at a few from the last 10 as having the most impact in the tradition. So the next one I want to look at is the Temiya Jataka, or the Mugapaka Jataka. It's known as both, depends on which edition you use. It's one of my favorites. It's a really striking Jataka, and I remember the first time I came across it, I was just stunned. I thought, ooh, this is an extraordinary narrative and very, very extreme and very intellectually evocative, especially from the perspective of children, what it's saying about children's capacities that we, I think, in the most part, cannot imagine. So in the Temiya Jataka, the setup is the following. After some prologue material, we get the queen, so the king in the Temiya Jataka, again, the Bodhisattva is going to be born as a prince. The king has not been able to sire an heir. He has 16,000 wives, and none of them seems to be getting pregnant. There's an obvious joke there, but eventually the queen, though, does become pregnant. And so the queen becomes pregnant, and there's a verse here that I think is very beautiful, where the queen's womb seemed to be full of diamond when she finally became pregnant. And when she became aware of it, she told it to the king. And this, again, I find very beautiful. I think there was a question last week from somebody about relationship between fathers and sons, because there's so much emphasis between mothers and children. Here, I think there's a real tenderness between the father and the son, and I think that happens right through the Bodhisattva's life, is the tension and the attention between the Bodhisattva and his father in multiple life stories is very powerful. And the struggle to let go is very powerful in all of those stories. So here, the queen's womb becomes full of diamonds. She tells about it to the king, and at last she brought forth a son, endued with the auspicious marks. And on the same day, 500 other young sons were born to other ministers. And at that moment, the king was seated on his seat, and he was surrounded by his ministers. When it was announced, "A son is born to you, O king." And at hearing it, and here's this beautiful line, "Paternal affection arose in him, and piercing through his skin, reached to the marrow of his bones, and joy sprang up within him, and his heart became refreshed." Very beautiful line. So you feel the attachment and the love and the joy that this child is going to bring to this king. He has waited so long. He has tried with 16,000 wives, and it never worked. And finally, the child has arrived. And so there's a great attachment to this child, not wanting this child to then walk away, right? And so that's going to color the narrative quite a bit. And when people come to see him, they say, "Are you happy about this?" And the people answer, the king asks them, "Are you happy?" And the people answer, "We were before helpless. Now we have help. We have obtained a lord." And so we see the attachment of the community to this child, right? The impact of this boy that has finally been born, and how important it is to the community and to the father in particular. And the mother is not as emphasized. She will come later. Now here's the part of the Temiya Jataka that's so evocative about children and their capacities. When the child was 1 month old, and so this is the part that I put up for you, They adorned him and they brought him to the king. And the king, having looked at his dear child, again, the intimacy is very strong, he embraced him and placed him on his hip and sat playing with him. And so you have a father who's playing with his son. Very nice moment. And now at that time, four robbers were brought before him. One of them he sentenced to receive 1,000 strokes from whips barbed with thorns, another to be imprisoned in chains, a third to be smitten with a spear, and the fourth to be impaled. The Bodhisattva, who, let me remind you, is 1 month old, on hearing his father's words, which apparently he can understand, was terrified, and he thought to himself, "Oh, my father, through his being a king, is becoming guilty of a grievous action, which brings men to hell." So the 1 month old is hearing, understanding, and contemplating the situation, and it worries him. So then he's sitting outside under an umbrella the next day, and while he's sitting under the umbrella, he contemplates his experience of the day before and wonders to himself, "How did I come to this palace?" And then he thinks through his past lives, which he has the capacity to do. And by his recollection of his former births, he remembered that he had once come from the world of the gods, and that after that, he had suffered in hell, and that he had been a king in that very same city. And so he remembers that he was a king for 20 years, and then he suffered in hell for 80,000 years. And then he realizes, "Now again I am born in this house of robbers, and my father, when four robbers were brought before him, uttered such a cruel speech as must lead to hell. If I become king, I shall be born again in hell, and I shall suffer great pain there." And he became greatly alarmed, and his golden body became pale and faded, like a lotus crushed by the hand. Right? It's a very powerful moment for a child, and for an infant here, the umbrella over him. And so the goddess is watching this contemplation of this child, and so she speaks to him. And she was his mother in a past life, which is a nice detail. So in a previous birth, she had been his mother, and she comforts him, and she says, "Fear not, my child, Henya. If you really desire to escape, then pretend to be a cripple, although not really one. Though not deaf, pretend to be deaf. And though not dumb, pretend to be dumb. Putting on these characteristics, show no signs of intelligence." So he's given this advice when he's 1 month old, and he takes it. Now, stories about 1 month olds and newborns so easily could say, okay, this is just kind of a play. We can't take this too seriously. These are so beyond anything that we can reasonably accept. But the tradition is not going to hold to that. It's going to go much further. And so this 1 month old, at this very moment, hold on a second. The fourth precept is being endorsed here. These stories are dubiously written. I'm not sure I understand what you mean. If you want to explain that, I'm not sure what you mean by the stories are dubiously written. So the story is going to go much further. And for the next 16 years, Tamya is going to hold. Now, I realize that a lie is breaking the fourth precept, but where are you seeing? You'd have to explain a bit more. Sorry, I'm responding to this. Unless you're suggesting that these texts are a lie, which is... Oh, I see what you're saying, that he's lying. I see what you're saying. I'm sorry, it took me a second to... Well, first of all, again, he is a bodhisattva. And the bodhisattva, as a bodhisattva, he does not... the first precept is not to cause any harm, and yet in the Vasantra Jataka, he gives away his children, which causes harm to his children and to his wife. I don't think we can put the kinds of expectations that we have of a perfect Buddha onto the Bodhisattva and the Jatakas. That's exactly what the Jatakas are for, is this kind of exploration of his humanity before he transcends us. Do you see what I mean? So I don't know if there's all kinds of behavior that happens in the Jatakas that are not perfect, and they're not supposed to be. I hope that's helpful to you. I think once we get to the Buddha as the Buddha, then that's where the discussion of perfection is to arise, but not with the Jatakas. And I think that's what makes them so popular, is that they're so complex and human and messy. So yes, you're right. She's suggesting he lie, and then he does for 16 years. You're very right. And so for 16 years, but this is the part that really just amazes me, is that for 16 years, the child is going to not move, not speak, not feed himself. He's not going to do a thing. He's going to sit in absolute stillness for 16 years. Now, I don't know about anybody watching this, but I probably couldn't do that for a week. And here's a one-month-old making this decision that's going to extend for his whole life. Now, his family doesn't believe him, right? So the family is seeing that there's something not right here. Either that, or it's this kind of natural parental wish that it can't be true when you imagine that something's wrong with your child. And so they refuse this behavior that has suddenly arisen. And they tell themselves, and the text describes the parents telling themselves, but he doesn't look like a cripple, and he doesn't, there's nothing about him that looks like this, and he was perfectly fine before. Why has he suddenly stopped moving? Something's not right here. And so they test him for the next 16 years, and they devise every, and the tests get really quite extreme and a little bit cruel, but they just can't believe that he is just, you know, crippled and deaf and dumb. They just can't. So the test that they put him under are really, most of the Tenia Jessica is about this. It's about these really radical tests that the parents put him through, because they can't believe that he really is stuck like this. So when he's an infant, they withhold milk and food, waiting for him to cry. And he doesn't cry. So eventually they feed him. When he's about five, they take all the other children as well. They test it, right? So it's kind of like, to me, I wonder if this is like the beginning of scientific testing, is that they take the other children who were born at the same time, who are all the same age, with Tenia, and they put them all in this hut together, and they set a fire to it, and they wait to see what happens. All the other children go screaming, running out of the hut, and Tenia sits there. He doesn't move until finally they run in and they save him and they pull him out. They same thing with the wild elephants and the venomous serpents. They take all the children, they put them, you know, on the road, then they set the wild elephants. All the children scatter, and Tenia doesn't move, right, until again they come and they save him. Using the opposite end, they throw these elaborate parties for all the children. The children are laughing and playing and they're happy. He doesn't move. So they can't kind of shock him out with pleasure either. They set a man with a sword kind of racing after the children. Again, he doesn't move. They this part really amazed me, is while he's sleeping, he has this kind of poster bed with material all around, apparently. And so in the middle of the night, they will put through the material, all of a sudden blow conch shells under his bed and around his bed and over his bed to scare him and kind of jolt him into wakefulness. He doesn't move. They smear him with molasses and they leave him to be swarmed by biting flies. And they even try not bathing him for a year, waiting for it to itch or to be uncomfortable in some way. These are very extreme tests. And every single time, Tenia thinks to himself that he's uncomfortable, but if he responds, it will be nothing like, you know, that the discomfort he's experiencing is nothing like the hell realm. And so he chooses not to respond, right? This is a very evocative narrative of a child who goes all the way for 16 years without moving, no matter what they do to him. So it's not as though he's sitting comfortably in a bed. He doesn't move no matter what they do to him. And so finally, as I'm sure many of you know, the end of the story, well, not completely the end, but eventually the king and the queen relent, and the king says to a chariot driver, take the child out and bring him to a charnel ground and kill him there and bury him. And that's what this image is here. It's a very popular image. So he's brought to the charnel ground, and while the man is digging the hole that he's going to bury him in, finally Tenia is free because he's outside the boundaries of the kingdom. And so he's free, and he moves his body for the first time, and he tests his strength, and he picks up his chariot to make sure he can move, and he whips the chariot over his head, and he thinks, oh yeah, I'm still good. And finally, he's free to go. Now, the thing that's very evocative also is clearly he's not a perfected character yet, because there must have been a way to diplomatically negotiate with his father. He didn't have to do this to himself for 16 years. So to me, this also says this is a character who's taking an extreme direction, right? So that, going to the question that you asked before, this is not a perfected character. No, it's not. Most people wouldn't have to do something like this to get out of not being a king, right? There are less extreme methods that you could use. But it shows his commitment as a child that he maintained all his life. So the last one, I'm going to go through it quickly because I want to move to the other material, the other precocious children. But another one that has a very strong presence of a child in the literature is the Maha Umaga Jataka. This is the story that takes place just before the Vikrantara. So he's really close now. He's just about near the end. And that is really evoked in this narrative. It's not ethically as complicated as is the Vikrantara Jataka. So this story begins, let me just find it in my book here. So this story begins with a king who has a dream, and he dreams of, here I can read it to you. Well, I don't need to read it to you, but he's got a dream of four fires in four different parts of the courtyard, as I describe here. And then he imagines a fifth fire that shoots up in the middle of the courtyard, and it completely terrifies him, and it's bigger than the four other fires. And he wakes up frightened by this big shooting pillar of fire. And so he goes to see his ministers, and he asks them what it means. And he has four ministers, and they say, the four pillars are us. Your dream says that one day a fifth sage will come and he will overshadow us all. And so this is going to be the Bodhisattva. And so the Bodhisattva is then going to be born. He's not born to the king. This time he's not a prince. And he's going to be born instead to a wealthy merchant family in the same kingdom. And just before he comes into the world, one of the gods puts a plant in his hand. And so he comes out of the womb with this plant in his hand. And again, we're going to have a talking newborn. So the great being sees the plant in his closed hand. And as he came from his mother's womb, she did not feel the slightest pain. So again, we have a very idealized birth. But he passed out as easily as water from a sacred water pot. And when his mother saw the piece of the medicinal herb in his hand, she said to him, "My child, what is it that you have?" And he replied, "It's a medicinal plant." Right? And so again, we have this conversation between the mother and the newborn. And he placed the plant in her hand, and he told her to take it and give it to all who are afflicted with any sickness. So she takes that plant, and she goes to see her husband, and she says, "Rub this on you, because this should heal you." And he had been suffering from headaches for 7 years, and so he rubs it on his head, and he's immediately cured of his headaches, and so this works. So we have this miraculous birth story again, a miraculous kind of interaction between the mother and the child, and this capacity to heal right from the beginning. Now, the text actually skips rather quickly, and all of a sudden he's 7 years old. 7 years old is going to be the age of seven is going to come up a lot, and we're going to see it in the next series of narratives. So he grows up. He's 7 years old. He's going to grow up with all of these thousands of children who are born on the same day as him again, another pattern that we keep seeing in all these narratives. And they play together outside all of the time, but sometimes there's rain and sometimes there's wild elephants, and so it's not always practical to be playing outdoors. And so one day there's a terrible rainstorm, and the children go running and falling over each other as they try to get away from the rainstorm. And he thinks to himself, you know, this is not a good way to be playing. We need a hall to be built to take care of us, because this is it's not a good thing for all these children to be playing outside. Now, he's 7 years old, and he decides on this hall. And so he says, "Let's build a hall here where we can stand, sit, or lie in the time of wind or hot sunshine or rain. So let each one of you bring one piece of money." So everybody's going to contribute to this. And so they all bring the money. So the thousand boys did so, and the great being, this is wonderful, the great being sends for a master carpenter, and he gives them all the money and tells them to build a hall. Now, he hasn't asked his parents for permission here. He's functioning entirely on his own agency. He took the money, the carpenter, and leveled the ground and cut posts and spread out the measuring lines. But he didn't grasp the great being's idea. So he told the carpenter how he was to stretch out the line, to do it properly. The carpenter replied, "I stretched out the line according to my practical experience. I cannot do it any other way." So the Bodhisattva asked, "If you don't even know how can you take our money and build a hall? Take the line. I will measure it, and I will show you." And so he took the line, and he himself drew out the plan, and it was done as though Viswakarma had done it himself, who's the architect of the god realm. Then he said to the carpenter, "Will you be able to draw the plan in this way?" And he said, "No, I won't be able to." He says, "Well, will you be able to follow my instructions?" And he says, "Yes, that I will be able to." And so the Bodhisattva is the one who's now the architect of this hall. He's 7 years old. And he has the entire hall built to his specifications. No adults are involved except for the carpenter. And the hall that he builds is not just a room for the kids to play in. He ends up building basically what looks like a palace. And so it includes the following. This is the list of the following rooms that are included: a place for strangers, lodging for the destitute, for women, for priests, one for merchants to sell their goods, a space for sports, a court of justice, and a hall for religious assemblies. And so he's basically built a palace, right? How this 7-year-old realizes that all of these needs need to be met is really quite extraordinary. Now, eventually the king wants to find this fifth pillar. And so he sends his ministers out to find him. And one of the ministers comes across this palace or this big hall that's been built. And he thinks, oh, this must be the kid. This must be the sage. And he's told, who is the one who did this? And they say, it's the child, Mahosada, who's the name. So he realizes he's found the sage, and then the story gets quite complicated. The ministers are jealous. They don't want this child to come to the court because they realize they're about to be replaced. And so they stall and they stall and they stall, but finally the king, through a series of riddles, finally manages to invite the father and the son. But he does it with a particular wordplay, which we don't need to go into right now. But the wordplay involves a kind of mule and a horse, and he invites most excellent, I mean, it's kind of a distraction from the narrative, but basically he invites them both. The father goes first, and the son tells him, "You are to go first because of how this riddle was formed, and I will go after. And when you go, I will ask for your seat, and you should give it to me." And so this is all prepared in advance. And the father accepts. So when the father goes, he sits down, and then the son arrives afterwards, and the king offers him a seat, and he asks to take his father's seat. And the father gives the son the seat. And the king is horrified, because this is a complete break of decorum. And Mahosada's response to this is amazing. He says, "What? You think that in all cases the sire is better than the son?" And so this is a direct challenge to ordinary hierarchies. Normally the father is to have respect, and the son has to offer it. And here the son is arguing, but it's not always true. Sometimes the son is better than the father, right? And then the text, just to make sure nobody imagines that, you know, the Bodhisattva is being arrogant or has no respect for his father, explains, no one knows better than the Bodhisattva the value of parents. If one asks why he did so, it was not to throw contempt on his father, but when the king sent the message, "Send the better horse and the more excellent," there's a play on words there between mules and horses, he did this in order to solve that problem, to make his wisdom to be recognized, to solve the riddle, and to take the shine out of the four sages who were being arrogant, right? And so the way to prove his point is to also remind you sometimes the child is better than the father, right? These are really extraordinary, countercultural, challenging narratives that tell you over and over again, children can be extraordinary, can have an extraordinary capacities. I think a lot of this has to do with coming from a samsaric worldview where people are being recycled. And if we're being recycled and we're going through reincarnation over and over again, we can't quite identify how old anyone is for real. So that you can have a very old man who's much earlier on in his spiritual career of attainment, and you can have a child who's on the very verge of achieving awakening. And so the ordinary hierarchy of elders being superior to youngers, to youngsters, really doesn't apply from this perspective. And I think that's what this tradition is saying with these narratives. The Bodhisattva, you don't know who a Bodhisattva is. You can't tell. And so anyone you meet might be a bodhisattva just on the verge of achieving awakening, right, if we take the term on a more kind of a global scale of what a bodhisattva is. Any one of them could be on the verge of attaining awakening. And so the seven-year-old may know so much more than you, right? The hierarchies of age just collapse with this worldview. That's, to me, very exciting. Okay, I'm going to leave the bodhisattva here. There's a lot more we could say, but I want to go to one of my favorite narratives and great picture. I hope you guys smiled when you saw that. That there's, in the literature, it's not just the bodhisattva that has these kind of extraordinary capacities as a child. There are all kinds of narratives of specifically seven-year-olds attaining a great deal and attaining arhanthood in the literature. So it's not reserved to the future Buddha. Anyone can be on this trajectory and just on the verge of attaining awakening, and if they can attain it at seven, right? Which, again, gives so much value to children, right? Which is what I'm so fascinated by, that we've missed it all this time, at least in Western academy. You guys have been quiet for a bit. I hope everyone is doing okay and I haven't put you to sleep. Okay, so here's this one story. I gave you the PDF. I think it's available somewhere. Oh, thanks, Analeo. So there's this story that I love. It's from the Dhammapada Commentary. I haven't found it anywhere else. If anyone knows of a parallel narrative to this, please tell me. I think it's just a masterful narrative. Oh, there we go, Bhikkhuni. Jonathan Silk and Venerable Analayo have both pointed out how the newborn bodhisattva knew all, right, taking a seven steps. But then as a young adult, he knew nothing. This is very true. And was portrayed as in need of encountering a sick man, old person, etc. Venerable Analayo, Genesis Bodhisattva idea, has shown that the idea of a super developed and precocious baby, and also that of the four encounters, are later textual development. He's an exceptional child since he doesn't need to undergo development education when the defining aspect of childhood doesn't need to be absentee. This is a wonder. This paradox, it's a wonderful paradox, and it's right through his narrative. And you find a lot of the commentators wrestling with this as well. Did he know everything, or did he know nothing? Was it all a play? And so Mahayana literature later is going to make this into a play. It's his lila. So he knew everything, but he's playing it out. As a historian, I would certainly suggest that a lot of these narratives are later additions to a more human narrative, and so we render him more extraordinary, which is a natural effect. But I think this struggle is constantly there. A parallel would be if Christianity ever had developed this kind of literature, they would probably have to struggle with the same thing. What is God as a child? Same thing with Krishna. You have this where you have stories where he is just extraordinary and others where you don't know that he's really a god. I think this is a natural kind of struggle in a tradition that has an idealized character. So yes, this is wonderful questions, and this struggle is right through the literature. Thank you, and it's nice to hear your voice out there. Okay, so this is the story that I love. The story is called The Four Novices. It's in the Dhammapada Commentary. I haven't found it elsewhere. I gave it to you because I think you should have it. And I think it's such fun. I think it's playful. I told it to my son. I use him sometimes as I want to see what his reaction is to some of these stories, because I think sometimes these stories may have been written for children. I think there's a real possibility there. So what would their response be? And so the story is that there's a wife of a Brahmin who desperately wants to make an offering to four arhats. This is her goal. She needs to give to four arhats. The term that's used is actually Brahmin, but Brahmin in literature is often interchangeable with an arhat and is understood as that. So she sends her husband. She says, go find me four Brahmins, four arhats, and bring them back here. Go to the monastery, ask for them, because I want to make an offering to them. And so she prepares the food and she makes these beautiful seats, you know, like probably covered with cloth and everything else, and she's waiting. The husband goes to the monastery and says, can I have four Brahmins, please? We'd like to make an offering. And so they give him four novices. He forgot to specify old. So they give four 7-year-old children. And these four 7-year-olds are who had attained arhatship. And the text is really clear about this. These are 7-year-old novices that can't be fully ordained yet, but they have achieved arhatship. And their names are Sankicha, Pandita, Sopaka, and Revata. So she's waiting, and he brings home these 4 children. I mean, this is just wonderful, because at the sight of the novices, she's filled with rage and sputtering as when salt is dropped on a heater. She says to her husband, "You've gone to the monastery and you brought back with you 4 youngsters not old enough to be your grandsons." And so she refused to let them sit on the nice seats that she has prepared, and she puts some low seats to the side. She says, "Go sit over there." And then she gets mad at her. She says, "Go back." It's a very commanding, angry wife. And she says, "Go back and you go get somebody else, because this is not what I wanted." So he goes back as a dutiful husband, and he comes back with Sariputta. I mean, can't get much better than that unless you bring the Buddha. And so he comes back with Sariputta, and she's thrilled. Right? And so he comes, and he said, and Sariputta reaches the house. He sees the novices who are sitting on the low chairs. He doesn't say anything about that, but he says, "Have these Brahmins received food?" And she says, "No, they have not received food yet." Now, he knew that food for only 4 people has been cooked. And so when he looks at the kitchen and he looks at the 4 boys, he knows they haven't been fed and they won't get fed if he eats. So he says, "No, give me my bowl," and he leaves. Now, she's very surprised by it. She doesn't understand what's going on, but she says, "Okay, go again." So now the husband goes again, and this time, obviously, if he has Sariputta the first time, he's going to get Moggallana the second time. So now Moggallana comes, and he sees the 4 novices. And he says, the 4 novices, you know, haven't eaten yet. And he says to them, you know, "Have they eaten?" They say, "No." And he says, "Well, then bring me my bowl." And he takes his bowl and he leaves. And so the Brahmin's wife says to her husband, the only thing she can figure from this is, these elders don't want to eat. "Go to the Brahmin's pail and bring back with you just 1 old Brahmin. I just need 1 old man, because old age is where, you know, the venerable status comes from." The novices had nothing to eat, and they're children, right? They're famished with hunger, but they don't move, and they don't say a word. But their hunger is what awakens the god Sakka. And so Sakka, who's Indra in later narratives, feels the poor children's hunger, but they won't move because they've attained so much, and so they don't need to express their hunger, but they are still in children's bodies. And so he's upset for these children. So their child's bodies are being emphasized here. So Sakka comes down and disguises himself as an old Brahmin to try to get the story moving along. And the husband sees this old Brahmin, and he goes, "Perfect, you're exactly what I wanted." And so he says, "My wife will be delighted. This is fabulous. This is what we needed." So when the Brahmin's wife saw him, her heart was filled with delight. And she took the rugs and mats, which were spread over the 2 seats, and spread them over. "Noble sir, sit here, this good seat that I've prepared." Sakka enters the house, the 4 novices. And then he finds a place for himself at the edge of the seats where the novices were sitting, sat down cross-legged on the ground, not on the high seats, so that he's honoring their status and lowering himself before them. So now we have an old man sitting below the children. When the Brahmin's wife saw him do this, she said to her husband, "You brought here a Brahmin, but you brought back with you 1 old enough to be your father. He's going about saluting children not young enough to be his grandsons. What use do we have of him? Like, this, something's wrong with this one. He's so old, he doesn't know what's what. He's saluting these children. This is ridiculous." So she says, "Get rid of him. Put him out." She's a very rude woman, I think. And so the husband, again, dutiful, picks up the man and tries to seize him by the shoulder and pull him by the arm, pull him by the waist, but Sakka will not move. So finally the wife jumps in, and together they each take an arm and they drag the man out of the house. It's just terrible rudeness here. So they pull him out of the house, finally, they throw him out the back door, and when they come back into the house, he's still sitting there. Right? Wonderful magic trick. My son loved that. So they see him there, and they screamed with terror, and they let go. At that moment, Sakka reveals his identity. And so they understand, and everything is made clear to them, and everyone is fed. And then they leave magically through the 5 doors of the house, the 5 openings of the house. And the house is then known as the house of the 5 openings. So after everyone is fed, kind of very quick ending to this dramatic build-up. All five of them, you know, take off, one through the floor, one through the ground, one through the roof, one through the back door, the front door, and one another way. And they all just disappear and go back to the monastery. And of course, what's wonderful is when the children get back to the monastery, the monks ask them, weren't you upset that you were treated this way? This is terrible. And they say, no, we weren't upset. And that's because they really were Arhats, and they accepted things as they were. This is just a masterful story. And it really shows that we really can mistake children in their capacities. When I told my son this story, I said, what do you think? And he said, yep, adults underestimate us all the time. Right now, my child's not an Arhat, but this sense that we can miss children in their capacities. And here is, in the Buddhist literature, so much material telling us children, you don't know what you're looking at. You don't know who someone is. You don't know who someone's capacities are. Their physical, biological bodies don't say anything about what their inner capacities are, because they could be 7 years old, but they could be moments away from Arhathood. Right? And so this is what is so compelling and gives such value and agency to children and their capacities in this tradition. And all of this really does come out of this kind of samsaric meta-narrative. The one life, you know, each life is like a scene in a very long movie. You don't know which scene you're looking at, so you can't judge. Right? I don't know if people have questions, because I can tell you the stories of some of these Arhats, because they're really wonderful. I'll tell you the story of the first Arhat, Sankicca, because it's the most developed. The other three, they're all a lot of fun, but Sankicca is the most developed and really highlights this notion of the seven-year-old child being extraordinary. Paticca Samuppada explains, Avijja, we are born but not having the notion of recollection. Yes. I'm not sure where you're going with that. What are you trying to say with that? That because we don't have this recollection, I'm not quite sure what you're doing with that. But yeah, we're supposed to... The idea generally with the notion of recollection is that it comes with greater awareness and spiritual practice, like the story of the Buddha, remembering all of his past lives when he achieves awakening, but precisely we don't remember, but we are, right? And so we don't know how far we've come, but we have come from somewhere. That much is clear. What I'll do is I'm going to tell you a couple other things. I'm going to skip the stories of the three novices because there's only like 15 minutes left. I'm going to tell you a few things about how the tradition, a couple of art, statements that are made about children in Buddhism, and then if we have time, I'll go back to some teacher's narrative and we can end on that note. I think that might be a better way to organize things. I'm going to fast forward here. There's a wonderful passage in the Milinda Panha because over and over again we have these seven-year-olds. So we have these four novices that are all seven, have wonderful stories. Revita's story is very funny. He runs away. He's being married off when he's 7 years old. He's actually Sariputta's youngest brother. All of Sariputta's siblings have become monastics. And Sariputta's mother, who is famous for having been a difficult woman, is terrified that Revita is also going to become a monk, and then she'll have no grandchildren. And so when he's seven, she decides she's going to marry him off so that he can't become a monk, which we know doesn't really stop anything, but this is her plan. And so she decides to marry him off at seven. And Sariputta, who's kind of Yoda-like in this moment, realizes that this is going to happen, and he instructs the monks at his monastery, if Revita comes and he asks to become a monk, I am his mother and his father, and you can give him permission to enter the order. His parents know nothing. It's a really striking detail in the narrative. He again overrides the family line and takes the role of parents, and he says, you let him become a monk. And then Revita is on his way to getting married, and he catches a glimpse of his bride's 120-year-old grandmother. And somebody says, you know, may wife live as long as her grandmother. And he sees the grandmother. He says, is she going to look like that? And they say, well, if she lives 120 years, she will. And he thinks, well, I'm out. So he has this kind of classic trope that happens over and over again. Liz Wilson's book, Charming Cadavers, is a fabulous interpretation of these narratives. But he has this moment where he sees this, he's repulsed, he thought he was sensually attracted, now he's sensually disgusted. It's this classic trope in Buddhist discourse. And so he rejects the wife, and he has an amazing scheme. I said I wasn't going to talk about this, but such a good material. He has this amazing scheme to get away from the wedding procession, and he's in, and it's a child scheme. He gets in the chariot going on the wedding procession, and he tells him he has to pee. He goes, he pees, he comes back in the chariot. He does this 3-4 times. They think, wow, this child really has to go to the bathroom a lot. And then once they trust him, he goes again, and he runs away. And he goes to the monastery, and they don't look for him because they think he's going to be back soon. And he joins the monastery. So, and achieves arhanthood right away. So all four of them achieve arhanthood when they're 7, very quickly after they ordain. Samkhya, the moment the razor touches his head, he achieves awakening. There's a question about the rose apple tree scene in the final Buddha's life. What do I think of it? I think this is, well, again, how old he is, what's interesting about this is that he's not necessarily 7 or 8. The literature goes all over the map with this. Sometimes it's in the middle of his, like Buddha Gosha, I think, has it partway through the 4 sites. He sees, I think, the 3 sites, and then he has the rose apple tree scene, and then he sees the 4th site. So it's not always necessarily associated with his childhood, but it's definitely somewhere in his youth. But he doesn't achieve awakening there, because that's not the moment for it to happen. So it's his opportunity to begin exploring his mind, a moment of quiet, but he's going to have to do it as an adult. So he doesn't do it as a child. But once awakening is established and the Dharma is established, then other children can achieve it far younger. But he doesn't really have that kind of attainment. He only does it when he's an adult. If you have a more specific question other than what do I think, maybe I can answer you more effectively. But it's a very important moment in his narrative, because it gives him that insight of what's possible, but he doesn't achieve it. He has to achieve it as an adult in his narrative. Now, I've pulled out this passage, which I think is really fun, from the Melinda Panha. Obviously, this wonderful debate between Melinda and Nagasena. Nagasena, incidentally, was 7 years old when he joined the monastery as well. So it's another kind of 7-year-old character. There's so many, they're everywhere. And Melinda asks this question, the king asks this question, about, you know, who can achieve awakening and who cannot. And so Nagasena says to him, he who is born as an animal, even though he regulates his life aright, will not attain to insight, nor he who is born in the pratha realm, nor he who holds wrong views, nor the deceitful man, nor he who has slain his mother or his father or an arhant, nor he who has raised up a schism in the order, nor he who has shed a Buddha's blood, nor he who has furtively attached himself to the order, or has become a pervert, or has violated a sister of the order, nor he who, having been guilty of one or the other of the 13 grievous offenses, who has not been rehabilitated, or a eunuch, or a hermaphrodite, and whosoever is a human child under 7 years of age, even though he regulates his life aright, will not attain to insight into the truth. To these 16 individuals, and 16, it depends how you count them, comes to 16, there's no attainment of insight, even though they regulate their life aright. It's a very odd passage, right? It's telling us all of these people are just barred from achieving awakening in that lifetime, right? So we've got a really interesting list of people who just don't qualify. And Melinda's question is, but why the child? So all the other questions, all the other characters, he's not interested in. I mean, I'm really interested in why a hermaphrodite or a eunuch can't. But his question is, why can't a child of 7, under 7 years of age, achieve awakening? And the answer that is given really doesn't answer the question. So the following is the reason, O King, for my saying that an infant, even though he regulates his life aright, cannot attain to insight. If, O King, one under 7 years of age could feel passion about things, exciting passion, could go wrong in things leading to iniquity, could be befooled in matters that mislead, could be maddened as to things that infatuate, could understand heresy, could distinguish between content and discontent, could think out virtue and vice, then might insight be then insight might be possible to him. But the mind of one under 7 years of age is powerless and weak, mean, small, slight, obscure, dull, whereas the essential principle of nirvana is transcendental, important, weighty, wide-reaching, and extensive. I don't think he's answered the question. He's told us that anyone under the age of why 7 is the cutoff is what we don't understand. But we're told that before 7, the child, the mind of the child is too weak to understand this. After 7, the mind of the child can. Right? So we don't know why 7 is the cutoff point, what happens. One of the things that I'd like to look into eventually this summer, I'll work on this a bit more, is medical texts of Indian traditions to see if there was some kind of medical tradition associated with children of 7, if they believe that something important happened to the mind at that point. I think that would be one direction to look. But if there isn't anything quite like that, 7 seems to be kind of an arbitrary cutoff point, a little bit like 18 is in North America for an age of adulthood. 7 is the age, and at the age of 7, you have the capacity to attain insight. You can see, you can understand heresy, you can distinguish between contentment and discontentment, you can think through virtue and vice. These are the capacities of a 7-year-old, according to Nagasena and Melinda Panha. I think that's a very powerful statement. The development of the brain and the prefrontal cortex. Well, I don't think they were talking about the prefrontal cortex back then, but there are some really interesting... Today, there are arguments being made that the brain continues to develop well into the 20s and 30s. Yes, you're right. There's a lot of research now on when does the brain reach complete maturity. It's much later than 7. That, there's no question. So, obviously, what we're understanding today from a scientific perspective is very different than what the authors of the Melinda Panha were imagining. But it's that same question of when is the brain ready? And for these authors, the brain, the mind, the person was ready at 7. So how much do we underestimate children or overestimate children? Clearly for the Buddhist authors of these texts at least, there's a tremendous amount of value being placed here, that children can do a lot more than we imagine. Now, maybe they were wrong, and they were assuming more than what we know now the brain is capable of. We realize now that teenagers have certain limitations in terms of their capacities to understand certain things. But for the Buddhist authors, this was not the case. As of 7, for whatever reason, 7 was the cutoff point, at 7, the child is capable of great attainment. And from that point on, now this may be also going backwards in time to justifying the story of Rahula, who at 7 follows his father, becomes the first child monk, and that then becomes the standard. Because otherwise the Buddha brought him in too young. So maybe that's what's happening. But I don't think that's the end of the discussion. So I'm going to explore this a lot more, and if any of you have any thoughts on it, I'd be really eager to hear it. Now, in the Anguttara Nikaya, there's a really interesting passage I came across, and there's another, it's repeated a few times. It's a kind of literature that we get in Buddhist discourse quite often, where Buddhist authors redefine traditional hierarchies. Oh, somebody found something on Wikipedia. Always a good source. Some suggest in children under the age of 4, the memory storage capacity limitation constrains comprehension. Then it's 4, not 7, perhaps related. I don't know. But I think we'd have to... Thanks, I'm going to look at that. That's fun. But I think that what we're discussing today in modern scientific studies of the brain is very different than anything... anyone had access to 2,000 years ago when these texts were being compiled. So we have to be careful not to apply, kind of cross too much, but it's definitely a direction to explore. So it'll be fun to see what happens at different ages so far as we can tell, and also what 2,000 years ago people imagined was happening to children as they developed. That's what I don't know. And I think that's more the relevant question as a historian, obviously. Okay. So we know that, I'm assuming a lot of you know, I shouldn't assume anything, but let's pretend, that in Buddhist discourse there's a lot of renegotiation of hierarchies and patterns. And so a famous one would be, question of caste. And so the Buddha gets asked often, what is a real Brahmin? A real Brahmin is X, Y, or Z. And he'll say, no, a real Brahmin is someone who attains insight. And so he challenges the hierarchy, challenges the caste system. Doesn't do away with it. He said, no, real attainment is this, not that. Real prayer in the right directions would be to pray with inwards and not outwards. So he's constantly challenging these kind of external characteristics and hierarchies around him. It's kind of a repeated pattern. For many parents, 7 is a lucky number, right? There's a definite reason for this momentous shift. The most significant changes of your brain occur at 7. Huh. Yeah, but would 7 have been a lucky number 2,000 years ago? There's definitely something here to explore. You guys are getting into this. It's fun. Okay. In early Buddhist texts, where? Ooh. Now we're definitely having fun. That would be great. Thank you. But then 5 is as well, and 3 is. And there's no end to this, isn't there? And 108. Okay, I'm going to write all of this down when we're done. Thank you. Okay. Oh, thank you. I'm glad you're enjoying the lecture. And see, there's a lot to know about children. We haven't really paid much attention to it, which goes back to my argument at the beginning. Okay, so just to look at this, before we wrap up, I'll have to close up in the next 10 minutes or so. So here in the Anguttara Nikaya, we get this wonderful reversal. So here... someone says, we've heard Master Gotama. The ascetic, somebody says, we heard that Gotama says this, that the ascetic Gotama does not pay homage to Brahmins who are old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, come to the last stage, nor does he stand up for them or offer them a seat. Well, this is indeed true. For Master Gotama does not pay homage to Brahmins who are old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, and come to the last stage, nor does he stand up for them or offer them a seat. This is not proper. It then occurred to me, these venerable ones do not know what an elder is, or what the qualities that make one an elder are. Even though someone is old, 80, 90, or 100 years from birth, if he speaks at an improper time, speaks falsely, speaks what is unbeneficial, speaks contrary to the Dhamma and the discipline, if at an improper time he speaks words that are worthless, unreasonable, rambling, and unbeneficial, then he is reckoned as a foolish, childish elder. But even though someone is young, a youth with black hair, endowed with the blessings of youth, in the prime of his life, if he speaks at a proper time, speaks what is truthful, speaks what is beneficial, speaks on the Dhamma and the discipline, if at a proper time he speaks words that are worth recording, reasonable, succinct, and beneficial, then he is reckoned as a wise elder. And so here, the tradition is very explicitly overturning the hierarchy. Child and elder is not what it seems. Biology is not our limitation. It's just the limitation of this particular life. And so if a child speaks properly and with wisdom, that is the definition of an elder. That is not the definition of a child. Your physical age and what you appear to be is not what you are, right? And so here you can also think of narratives in which people shift body sexes. And so I'm thinking, not in the Pali Canon, but the very famous scene in, that famous text. Where you switch man and female. I lost it. I'll remember it and then I'll tell you. But there's another passage, also in the Dhammapada commentary, that does the same kind of thing, just to show it's not just this. No, I'm not thinking of Soreya. There is also the Soreya narrative, but I'm thinking of a Mahayana text. Vimalakirti Sutra. How can I forget that? The Vimalakirti Sutra, where there's a scene of people switching male and female just to prove that the physical body and the limitations in gender and sex are not substantial. They have no essence, right? And so here, age is being treated in the same way that age has no essence, right? Hold on. Oh, we're getting stuff on the age of 7. We're getting, do you think the capacity of children is explained the punishment is due to their past karma and achievements? Is there any differentiation regarding the capacity between growth? Okay. Let me hold this. Let me read you this last part, and then I'm going to get to those questions. So this, again, is in the Dhammapada commentary. And the question that is being asked is, can a young monk be an elder? So one day, an elder went to wait upon a teacher, and as he left, the 34th monk saw him. So an elder goes to wait upon a teacher. The 34th monk sees him. The monks went to the teacher, saluted him, sat down respectfully to his side. The teacher, perceiving that they were ripe for arhatship, asked the question, did you see a certain elder leave the place? And they answer, no, we didn't. You didn't? Well, we saw a certain novice. So then he responds, monk, he was no novice. He was an elder. He was exceedingly young, though. But monks, I do not call a man an elder merely because he is old, because he sits in the seat of an elder. But he who comprehends the truth and is ever kind to others, he is the elder indeed. Right? So it's again the same kind of thing that we see here. It's a repeated trope in the literature. Right? You don't know who the elder is. Okay, so we have this question. Bhikkhu Anilayo, that's brilliant. According to Dumont, the number 7 in ancient India indicates a totality. Okay, I'm going to have to write all of this down because this may actually solve the question. If 7 is the totality, is when you reach wholeness, then that would explain all of this. Oh, that was fun. Okay, thank you so much. That's very exciting. Deva Priya Ghosh writes, do you think the capacity of the children as explained by the literature is due to their past karma and achievements? Yes, absolutely. That's something that comes up. So in a lot of the stories of, you know, Samkhicha and Revata and Nagasena, all of these amazing children that become arhants. I don't know if Nagasena, I have to check the story again, but I don't remember exactly where in his narrative he achieves arhantship, but he has the desire to enter the monastery at 7. That in all of these cases, you have these kind of past life stories that explain where they come from in a lot of cases, that justifies why they've been born in this life and they're on the verge of achieving arhantship. So absolutely, karma and rebirth is really what explains all of this. This is why we can have a child that can achieve arhantship and we can have an old man who's not achieved it. Right, is that it depends on your karma and where you come from, and you can't know where people come from. That's what's so striking about this. If you eliminate karma and rebirth, all of this narrative has to go. Right? Or if you don't, then you're left with that kind of age-old, really troubling question, why do some people have certain talents and other people don't? Karma answers that question. If you get rid of karma, you're just left with this notion of the random accidents of some people wired in such a way to achieve certain things and some people aren't, and there's no rhyme or reason to it. From the Buddhist perspective, there is rhyme and reason to it. We are responsible for what we are born with. It is our responsibility because we have worked so hard in our past lives to achieve what we've achieved now. But if you eliminate that, then there's no responsibility. There's just kind of cosmic bumping into each other. That may be the fairest answer, but it's certainly not the Buddhist answer. Is there any differentiation regarding the capacity between the girl child and the boy child? So what's interesting is that all of these novices that I've come across lately are all boy children, and obviously the Bodhisattva is a boy child. I'm assuming I'm going to come across girl children who have great attainments. Here we have Visakha, who attains Sotapanna. So that's good, but I haven't seen... I'm waiting, I'm sure, you've got to be there, of a child, of a 7-year-old child, female child, who achieves arhanthood, but I haven't found it. And so we definitely have a gender bias there, and I'm hoping I'll find something. I mean, this Visakha example is a helpful one. I don't know. But it's a very dominantly male narrative. And, you know, the kind of the awkwardness of this lecture was that I was thinking that this is about South Asian Buddhist women, and my whole lecture is about young boys. I wish I could have found examples of female children, but I haven't very found very much. Now, Bhikkhuni Dhammadina says, 7 indicates a completed cycle in ancient India. Perhaps it also indicates a completed first cycle of personal development. Now, that's very smart. It's also used in some grammatical traditions, a woman must be at least 7 years younger than her prospective husband. You guys are amazing. Is there an electronic version of a little Buddhist book? I think Oxford made me sign a form that said that there would be an electronic form. So I'm hoping there's one out there. I think there should be. But if you write to me privately, I can send you an individual article, chapters, if you want particular chapters. I can certainly do that. I think my time is up, and I have my students writing an exam in a few minutes. So I might have to go. But I've had a lot of fun, and I'm going to have to write down all of these things. Hopefully, can we keep this chat? Can I get this chat back? Does it, like, exist somewhere in the world? Thank you. It was a real pleasure. Well, thank you. Bye. It was very male-dominating. Kuru Ragnarayo. It was a real pleasure. I don't even know how to get out of this, but...